for those that have been following this channel and following sort of the broader AI landscape, we have freaking satellites in space now doing AI.
So we just trained the first LLM in space with this H100. We're running the first version of Gemini on orbit with the spacecraft.
Wow.
The first words were from Gemini were, "Greetings, Earthlings."
I have Philip Johnston here with me today. Philip Johnston is the co-founder and CEO of StarCloud. For those that have been following this channel and following sort of the broader AI landscape, we have freaking satellites in space now doing AI, okay? As my tea's coming in from my wonderful wife. Thank you very much. Perfect timing. And so what I really want to do here with Philip is give you a little bit of time to introduce yourself, why y'all started StarCloud, why it's a big deal, and then I'd really want to dig into sort of some of the technical stuff, but also understand, you know, we were just briefly talking before we went live. This feels like a giant deal, like a really, really big deal. And we're just at the very early innings. So go ahead, Philip. Anything you want to let the people know as far as who you are, what StarCloud does, all that stuff, and then we'll get in the weeds.
Yeah, thanks so much, Fawzat. Thanks for having me on. So I'm Philip, the co-founder and CEO of StarCloud. And yeah, we're building data centers in space. And the main reason we're doing it is we're running up against these constraints on energy and water for data centers on Earth. And so if we move this stuff to space, we basically have limitless low-cost energy in the form of solar. And we also have this very cold ambient temperature, which we can emit heat in infrared out into. So we don't have to boil off all these, you know, basically sucking up rivers and reservoirs at the moment to keep data centers cool. We don't have to do that in space. So yeah, we've been going about 2 years. We're a team of engineers based in Redmond, Washington State. And we've just launched our first spacecraft. So that's has the first NVIDIA H100 on board. It's about 100 times more powerful GPU or AI compute than it's been in space before. And we've actually got some amazing results, which are about to announce. So we just trained the first LLM in space with this H100. We just did we're running the first version of Gemini on orbit with the spacecraft.
Wow.
Yeah, the first words were from Gemini were, "Greetings, Earthlings."
That's great. That's scary, but wonderful at the same time.
Yeah, I didn't know what the macro prompt behind that was, but we asked it for like a profound opening statement, and it said,
"Yeah, it said that." That's wonderful. How funny would it be if it's actually context aware? It's like, oh, I am in space. You know, that's what I'm going to say.
It literally is context aware. So like, we've plugged in the telemetry to it. So like, you can ask it like, hey, where are you now? And like, what does it feel like to be a satellite? And it will give you a coherent answer.
Oh my God. That's so wild, man. Yeah, it's so crazy. I think the thing that became sort of obvious for me as I was thinking through the, like, why is this something that makes sense was exactly that cooling, the sort of all the stuff that's outside of the actual training system, the getting the chip to actually run and not melt. That, and correct me if I'm wrong, that piece of it is somewhere between 80 to 95% of the physical structures usually here on Earth that take to actually run these clusters. Can you go into a little bit into depth into that? Why does it require so much to do it on Earth?
Yeah, I mean, so the racks that people are building now are just insanely power dense. What I mean by that is you might have one rack that is 100 kilowatts, and just pushing 100 kilowatts of that all gets turned into heat. Pushing 100 kilowatts of heat away from a rack that might be just a few meters cubed is very challenging. And so the way they do that on Earth is direct-to-chip liquid cooling. So you're pumping water past these chips. It warms the water, and then you push that water out to these radiators. Not radiators, out to a heat sink, sorry. And the heat sink is usually an evaporation tower or some other form of getting rid of that heat. It's either blow cold air past it or you're evaporating huge amounts of fresh water. So in space, we don't have either cold air or fresh water. And so it's a completely different challenge. And the way that we get rid of that heat is we build these enormous radiators, like deployable radiators. It's basically a large surface area that glows, if you will, in infrared. Like everything right now in the world, like if you had an infrared camera on your face, you would see that your face is glowing in infrared. It's the same for... if you keep a surface area warm in space, it will just emit that in infrared out into deep space. It's just a question of, can you keep the radiator hot enough and can you have a large enough surface area? And so we know that's solvable because the International Space Station has a radiator that's been doing it for decades. What's difficult is making it cheap and light. And that's the core of the engineering work that we're doing, is building these large, low cost and low mass deployable radiators to make it cheap and light, basically.
Got it. Okay. And so I'm going to say it back to you and let me know if I'm doing a good job here. Yeah. So basically, when you're in space, really the only way to cool things down is by radiating the heat away, because there's literally nothing else in space. And when you're thinking about space, if you're up there, you're a beautiful satellite, you know, roaming the cosmos, one side of it's going to be the Earth. So if you point one side, and the Earth is obviously has heat because it's a body that emits heat, right? So if you point your radiator to the Earth, your chips will melt because you won't be able to actually dissipate the heat. And so you need to point it somewhere that is like literally as close to absolute zero, just space, right? So you would basically have to point it towards a patch of the sky where the sun isn't there, the Earth isn't there, you know, maybe whatever else. It's just as black and as empty as possible. And then the, you know, physics, science, however you want to describe it, there are laws that allow you to basically say, okay, if you point this hot thing towards somewhere that is very, very cold, the heat will just transfer from the hot thing to the cold thing. Is that a fair way of describing that?
That's an incredibly good way of describing it. Most people don't actually realize that the Earth, even on the eclipse side, the dark side, the Earth emits a huge amount of infrared. And so, yeah, you need to point it to deep space, essentially.
Got it. And so if we're thinking about AI over time, there's going to be more and more needs for training compute, more and more needs for inference. But sort of the prevailing thesis here is that as AI systems get more and more useful, more and more people are going to want to use them, which is going to require more and more training compute. And then as we get into more and more complex things, like humanoid robots, as an example, humanoid robots are super complex. If like the example I like to use on this channel is, you have the self-driving cars, and I'll use a Tesla-specific one. Tesla has FSD. FSD drives the cars around. But then you think about the complexity of driving in relation to a human or robot's pretty simple, because you're kind of going forward, backwards, left, and right, and then sort of like you have to be context-aware. Whereas with a human or robot, you need neural nets for each finger, you know, your joints, your shoulder, right? So the amount of things you have to process to make the human or robot work is orders of magnitude more potentially. So the demand for those chips to be able to do those things becomes really, really high. And then you start running into these bottlenecks as you try to scale that up that says, like, okay, we either don't have the energy required on Earth to do it, or we're going to have NIMBYism, like not in my backyard, that says, I don't want a fucking training computer in my, what are you doing? Like, I don't want this here, right? Mm-hmm. And so literally just throwing it up into space bypasses all of that, right?
Yes, you're right. Broadly right. I would just add maybe one slight piece of nuance there.
Yeah.
Like the humanoid robot case, almost all of the inference for that will be done on the humanoid robot itself. So I presume what you're talking about is training.
And
most likely training runs will be run on Earth for at least the next decade or two. And the reason for that is, to run a training run, you need the whole data center to be internally networked. And that means you need like multi-gigawatt clusters internally networked. And we won't have a larger version of that in space than we do on Earth, probably for at least a decade. Whereas running inference for something like ChatGPT, for example, or you know, video gen inference, needs to be done in a data center. But it doesn't need to be internally networked. Like, you can run video gen inference on one H100, for example. And so it's much more likely that for the next decade, at least, we're just going to be running these inference nodes in space. I would say it's more on the inference side initially than it is on the training side. Over time, for sure, we're going to see very large structures for training as well, but initially just inference.
Okay, got it. So for the layman, so what that basically means is when you're doing all these like training runs for very complex things, you need a lot of interconnected systems that are very large.
Yes.
But when you're just doing chatbots, or you go to Nana Banana Pro and say, make me a picture of Farzad with a banana hat, that can go to space because that's relatively simple compared to the other stuff. Is that fair?
Exactly.
Correct. Okay, got it. Okay, so that's very good to know. So over time, how do you see the mix of training and inference? So like, if I'm thinking about one unit of power, right, to power either training or inference, how do you see
99% inference.
Okay. Can you help me understand that better?
Yeah. I mean, so already you see the shift. I think if you'd looked 3 years ago, what proportion of GPU compute was going, or just in general AI compute was going into training versus inference, it was probably like 80% of all compute was going, or energy was going into training. And that's because it was the first time you trained these like large models. So you needed massive runs. Then it was 50% a few years ago. Now it's coming down to, I think it's like 20%. And it's just dropping and dropping and dropping. And the reason is more and more people are actually using the results of these training runs. So like every time you put something in Gemini or ChatGPT, that's going straight to an inference node somewhere. That is going through the roof. The number of models you need to train every year is roughly stable. I mean, yes, you need more power to train the models, but it's not increasing by anywhere near the rate that the usage is increasing. And I expect that will continue, particularly when agents start being useful. When you start having, you can automate the whole back office of a company with agents, for example, then we're just going to see many more people setting up companies, many more back offices being automated. That will just drive compute through the roof.
Got it. Okay. So that's super helpful for me to know. So if I use a real world example, I'm assuming you're familiar with Replit, like the,
yeah.
So I've been using Replit a lot in the last, I don't know what the hell they did in the last few weeks, but it's turned into like a super, and I think they introduced the agents. I think they've introduced the ability to use agents. We're starting to really ramp up our sort of like projects around creating and grown, like homegrown tools for the business, so that instead of using all these different touch points for me to like, you know, create a script, come up with an idea, create a thumbnail, create a title, whatever, you know, give me a concept to think about, what's my research. Replit's now sort of bringing all this together in one-stop shop. And instead of working on seven different workflows, I work in one. So that feels like a gigantic deal, because if an idiot like me can do that, what are these like giant businesses or small businesses or people that haven't traditionally, it has like this internet effect of sorts, right? Where when you open up the floodgates of this technology to people, all of a sudden people start using it because it's so useful. And all of that work is inference, it's not training.
Exactly. Right? The other one that's going to be a massive consumer of energy is video gen, but not just video gen for, you know, like making a Sora video, it'll be video gen for everything, you know, for producing a GUI in real time. I think that's where that's where everything's going. It's real time GUI generation with video gen. And that will consume an absolutely gargantuan amount of, and then also like video games will be generated in real time with video gen, and that's going to consume unbelievable power.
Wow. And so if you were to sort of contextualize for me the amount of inference we have today versus what we'll have in 10 years or like even 5 years, is that a 10x, is that a 20x, like, or is that a 5x? How do you view that scale up of inference?
It scales at the rate that you can build data centers, basically, is how I view it. I mean, we're building data centers as fast as we can, I think it's roughly doubling every it slowed down a lot. It was doubling every 6 months. No, it was 10xing every 6 months for a little while. It seems like it's doubling at least every year, maybe every 6 months. That was slow though. There's no way you can carry on. The only way you can carry on growing at that rate is if you seriously ramp up orbital data centers, because there's no way, you can't build 100 gigawatts of new energy in the US per year.
Yeah.
You know, like in Texas, you know. You need to do it. That's the only place you can do that is in space. That's why if we want to see any kind of like meaningful continuation of the growth trends we're on, we need to start pumping data centers in space.
Thank you to the sponsor of this podcast, Rebellionaire. Rebellionaire partners with Tesla investors who have at least $2 million in Tesla stock to reach their financial goals. Other investment firms might look at your Tesla position and think, wow, you have way too much, this is way too risky, but Rebellionaire actually embraces the long-term potential of a company like Tesla. They'll also look to maximize your profits by employing different tactics like selling covered calls, adding or trimming, etc. And the Rebellionaire team, which includes Bradford Ferguson and Matt Smith, they do this by spending a lot of time analyzing Tesla, the company, in very novel and unique ways. They've done things like cross-country FSD trips, the self-driving suite that Tesla has. They've done a lot of novel research around the energy sector and the humanoid robot and AI sector as well. Make sure to go to rebellionaire.com/Farzad, rebellionaire.com/Farzad, and that's how they'll know that I sent you. Thank you very much. So let me walk through the, like, why, so why data centers in space from an energy perspective? And this is something I think maybe, like, it's interesting to conceptualize for the audience. So if I'm thinking about this, and correct me at any time, obviously, because you're the one who's actually doing this, not me. So we have a satellite that you guys have that you're throwing up into orbit, and this thing basically does the inference work for AI that you would have traditionally done on Earth. But because you're in space, you have the ability to put these things in a type of orbit, sun synchronous orbits, I guess they call them, where you can have them pointed at the sun for a huge majority of the time. And that basically powers the satellite to be able to run the inference. And that's why energy becomes such a no-brainer equation in space, because you're literally only limited by, well, obviously there's a lot of different limitations, but when it comes to the energy piece, it's like how long can you point the solar panel to the sun? And that's what generates the energy. Is that a fair way of describing that?
Yes, but in space, we can point that panel to the sun 24/7. So there's a specific type of orbit, and I'll try and explain it very roughly. If this is the sun, and this is the Earth is going around the sun like this, the Earth is spinning under the sun.
Hold on, Philip. I thought it was the other way around, bro. Come on.
Depends who you speak to. There's definitely conventions for people who think that.
Yes. I had to do it. I'm sorry.
So Earth spinning under. There's this thing called a dawn-dusk sun synchronous orbit. It's basically you're flying around the dawn and dusk line of the Earth. So as the Earth spins underneath, we're always in the sun. We're never... If you're flying like this, we're in sunlight here, and then we're in the shadow here, and then we're in the sunlight here. But there is this one very specific orbit in low Earth orbit, which is this dawn-dusk sun synchronous, where you never go behind the shadow of the Earth, and you're always pointing your solar panels as you go around, they're always facing. And that means your radiator is always pointing away. And also, Earth's albedo is not, you're not consuming a huge amount of infrared from the Earth, because you're kind of like flat on like this. And also, you don't block the sun during the day, and also you don't mean that the astronomers can't see stars at night. So it's honestly like an absolutely beautiful quirk of nature that this orbit exists.
Wow. And so does that mean that by default you're going to be limited by the number, like, because there's only one orbit you can put these on, are you limited by the number of things you can put in that orbit? Help me think through that.
We can launch many terawatts before we're limited by any kind of constraint there. And once we hit that constraint, then, you know, you can put things which are less latency sensitive. The only reason you want to put it there is because you need to be close to the Earth for low latency workloads, you know, sub 20 millisecond. Anything that's like a more batch processed agents, for example, like most business processing agents don't care about latency. Then you can put it in a lunar orbit or one of the Lagrange points or just a regular sun orbit. L3 and 4 have a fixed, or Lagrange point 1 or 2, they're, you know, relative to the Earth, they're kind of in a fixed position. But there's massive amounts of space there. I mean, you're scaling up to, exawatts, which is, you know, orders of magnitude, many orders of magnitude more than we currently have.
Got it. So when we have that problem, you and I are probably going to be 150 years old, and then we're not going to have to worry about it, basically. Got it.
Unless 150 maybe doable.
Okay. That's exciting. For that specific type of orbit, would you need to launch batteries as well, or is it just the solar panel? Because literally you can just point at the sun and forget it.
It's one of the biggest advantages of doing this in space is we don't need batteries. You have three big costs with terrestrial solar. Terrestrial solar is like the cheapest form of energy we have on Earth. Biggest cost in North America particularly can be the cost of permitted land. We don't have that cost. Second biggest cost is the cost of battery storage. We don't have that one. And the third biggest cost is the cost of the solar cells. And we need 8 times less solar cells, since 1 square meter of solar panel in space produces 8 times the energy of one on Earth.
Wow.
Your two biggest costs are gone, and your third is 8 times less. The only additional cost we have is the launch cost, and that's very rapidly trending towards zero. And, you know, there's clearly a break-even point where the launch cost is below the cost of permitted land, batteries, and solar, and we think that's around $500 a kilo where the break-even is.
Got it. How do projects like SpaceX's Starship accelerate something like this? Because as I'm thinking through that, you know, one of the things that we do on this channel, we cover Musk industry very closely. And one of the things that I've been thinking through is like, okay, so Elon's been talking about this Starship project for the longest time. And it's like, okay, we're going to Mars. We're going to Mars. Very, very cool. But you need something to like, you know, gives you some sort of ROI. So you're not just dumping money into this thing and it's just like crashing into Mars 20, you know, whatever, and taking humanoid robots there. And it's like, okay, you know, the ROI will be in 100 years. It's like, it has to be something similar to the Falcon 9, where Starlink was born to pay for Falcon 9. So how do you view Starship's developments and sort of its ability to achieve reusability here in the next, hopefully, couple of years, like consistent reusability? How does that open the floodgates for you guys to be able to throw stuff into space?
I mean, it really, opening the floodgates is the correct way of describing it. It really does open the floodgates for not just us, but for anybody that has a use case which makes sense when you have much lower launch costs. And I would say floodgates is the right way of thinking about it because it's fully reusable. And because they're building so many of them, you know, they're planning on building 3 Starships a day. Can you imagine?
No.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's mind-blowing. Yeah. If you built 3 Starships a day for a year, the difference between Falcon 9 and Starship is if you built 3 Falcon 9 every day for a year, at the end of the year, you still only have 3 Falcon 9s because all of the others are expendable. If you build 3 Starships a day every day for a year, at the end of the year, you have 1,000 Starships. Each one has 5 times the payload capacity of Falcon 9. Each one can fly 5 times as frequently, the booster. So, I mean, it's like you're talking about at least 1,000 times more capacity, to like tonnage per year to orbit than we currently have. And that is just like impossible to imagine right now.
Wow.
So,
So one of the things that I've been sort of, as I'm trying to explore this technology, it's, you know, and again, it's nascent. And I know, you know, the reason why you guys put the H100 up there is to kind of figure out, okay, how long does it, I'm assuming, how long does it last for? Are we, you know, are we running into sort of any variables that we didn't think about? You know, is the coolant appropriate? Are we getting as much energy as, well, whatever? Like, there's so many different things that you guys are walking through. But when you guys throw something up there for inference, how long do you expect them to stay up there for to do actual, like, compute? Like, help me understand the life cycle.
Yeah, so right now it's very similar to the Starlink satellites, which is a 5-year lifetime we're projecting for the chips and also the satellite structure. There's an argument to be made that they may last longer, and the reason is our marginal cost of energy is zero once we've launched. So you'd stop using a chip in an Earth-based data center once the dollars per hour, let's say it's a 1 kilowatt chip, once the dollars per hour that you can generate from it is below like 8 cents per kilowatt hour, which is what you might pay to the grid, then you stop using the chip. Our marginal cost of energy once we've launched is not 8 cents per kilowatt hour, it's zero. So there's an argument to be made that we can actually use these chips longer. The other thing is, over time, you can imagine we might start docking, might start leaving the infrastructure in place for longer. So you could have the solar panels lasting for 20 years and radiators, and then you can dock in and out the chips, which is what we showed in that concept video we have.
Got it. Okay. So once you throw it up there, they're going to be up there for a minute. So it's not a thing where every like year. So I guess one of the things I was reading, maybe this is on the training side. One of the things I was reading is like, correct me if I'm wrong, but like there have been times, or I don't even, I don't know if this was like a Michael Burry short thesis that leaked it. It like kind of made its way into the, sort of the stuff that I think through. But one of the things I read was the chips don't last as long as it would make sense to throw it up in space, because by the time you throw it up in space and it's up there for about a year or two, it sort of it uses its ability to do computations or whatever. But you're saying
about the radiation, space is a higher radiation environment, and so the traditionally things degrade over time. We're working on some both shielding and software solutions to enable us to use the chips as long as you would on Earth. And I think that the nice thing about shielding is the shielding scales with the surface area of the satellite and the compute scales with the volume, which means the larger the spacecraft, the lower the proportion mass that goes into shielding. So this is a problem which will be solvable.
Got it. So it's one of those things where as you get bigger, because obviously as you're thinking about sending stuff up into space, the weight is the most important thing, right? Because for a per unit of useful thing, the heavier it is, the less useful it's going to be, but the lighter it is, the more useful it's going to be, because you're going to be able to throw more things up there along with it, right? How heavy is the shielding in comparison to, if you can disclose that, is that a significant percentage of the...
As I say, when you've only got one chip, it's a significant portion of it. But when you have a lot of chips, then it trends towards 0%, you know, much less than 1% of the total mass. If you have a lot of chips, we'll go into shielding.
Got it. Okay. What is the biggest, like, if you're thinking about the project you guys are going through right now, what is the hardest thing you guys are working on right now? Like, as much detail as you can provide.
Yeah. So there's two big engineering challenges with what we're doing. Number one is, how do we dissipate all this heat in a vacuum? And number two is, how do we make these chips work in a high radiation environment?
What was the first one, Philip? I'm sorry.
How do we dissipate the heat in a vacuum?
Got it.
Yeah. So about 70% of our engineering team is working on this radiator. So building a very large, low cost and low mass deployable radiator. And that's not a physics problem. It's an engineering problem and a manufacturing problem. Like, how do we manufacture this radiator cheaply and efficiently and at low mass and low cost? The other one is the chips. And for that, it's all about putting them in particle accelerators, testing them, understanding where an H100 fails. I think I don't know if I said before, but I think we're the only people in the world that know where an H100 will fail if you blast it with high velocity protons and heavy iron. Because we put it in the particle accelerator, one in Brookhaven National Lab and one in Knoxville for proton, wow, heavy iron. So that informs then our choice of shielding. Those are the two biggest engineering challenges working on now.
Got it. So what's interesting about that is, it's so fascinating to think about this, right? Because, you know, when I'm thinking about a layman like me, when it comes to this stuff, right? When I'm thinking about putting stuff in space, it's like, okay, well, one of the hardest things is going to be just like doing it so it goes on the rocket and it goes on the rocket. It's like, no, it's the radiator. It's like dissipating the heat is the toughest engineering challenge. Because if you're able to do that, that's what enables you to go up into space.
Exactly.
That's what makes it economically viable. So how much of that? So this feels like a huge competitive advantage if you're able to develop a really good radiator, right?
Yes.
Are you guys vertically integrating that? Like, how you guys are thinking about the manufacturing process for that?
Yeah, the radiator we're doing all in-house because we have to. Nobody else makes a radiator that's anywhere near the size and scale of what we need. So we are, everything on the radiator is done in-house. We have some very unique and interesting manufacturing techniques for that.
Yeah. Have you guys discovered other use cases for this, like on Earth? Like, is there, or is this just like this? Yeah.
There's many other use cases in space. I mean, basically any high energy use case in space is going to need to get rid of the heat. And even if you were to run data centers, for example, using nuclear fission or fusion in space, you would still need a very large, low cost and low mass deployable radiator. But then basically every high energy use case. So if you wanted to do sort of larger scale manufacturing in space, you would need to get rid of the heat. If you wanted to do refining of lunar resources or asteroid mining or any of those kinds of applications, you'll need to get rid of that heat in a vacuum. If you wanted to do space hotels, you know, like the International Space Station has this radiator for a reason, and you would have the same problem if you had a much larger sort of space hotel. So there's many applications of space radiators in general.
So I'm in like 5-10 years time, I might be able to go to like radiator.com and it's you guys. Potentially, right?
Yeah, but hard pivot into radiator manufacturing. Yeah.
That's so cool, man. Go ahead, please. No, please.
The problem with being a, like, there's a world where I'm sure somebody's going to make a very profitable business being a component manufacturer of radiators. The problem is, like, anytime there's a thing like this where you need lots of it and you need it to be manufactured cheaply, the Chinese just end up like crushing everybody. So I imagine like the Chinese are going to make radiators very cheaply at some point. They won't be able to sell orbital compute because nobody's allowed to use Chinese satellites for orbital compute. At least no Americans are. So we know we have a bit of a moat there, but I don't think our edge is going to be component manufacturing for radiators.
Got it. Do you view it more as like your ability to package it into one like solution and having that as the like the thing that lives in space? Is that how you view your long-term moat?
Yes.
Got it. Got it. That makes sense. And so I'm guessing if you're able to do that, like how difficult is it to jump between like launch providers? Like if you want to go with New Glenn versus Starship versus whoever else, I'm guessing like how difficult is that to manufacture for the different launch capability, like the different rocket companies basically?
Yeah, it's a good point because so Starship has this Starlink V3 PEZ dispenser form factor. And that's very specific to Starship, and I doubt that will be operational on any other launch vehicle. And I would imagine that most of the space industry will start designing spacecraft to that form factor because it's just going to be so much cheaper than any other launch vehicle, at least for the next five, maybe 10 years. We're very hopeful that New Glenn and Stoke and Relativity and all those guys and Rocket Lab, can compete and can produce a launcher that is low cost. At the moment, it doesn't look like any of them are really trying to make something on the scale of Starship, so that's reusable. So, it could be that Starship has an incredible monopoly for quite a long time.
Wow. Okay. Is there? I guess the best way to fight through that or to sort of solve for that problem is to partner with as many players as possible to be able to sort of where you all can land on like the agreed upon. And again, I'm super, super dumb when it comes to this stuff. Like, I don't know anything when it comes to it, but I'm assuming it's like a sort of standard business process where you're like, okay, let's get together. Let's figure out how you guys can help us. And we'll obviously give you money to put our stuff up there. And then eventually you'll find a partner that's able to match your production capacity, because I'm assuming you guys want to go as fast as possible, right? Is that the thought process?
Yeah. You can think about that. Yeah.
I mean, got it.
I have a slightly different opinion than most in that I don't think it's necessarily... So some people think if SpaceX has a monopoly on launch, does that mean that the launch price never comes down? And I don't think so necessarily because they're building so much capacity. It will be in their interest to sell it at a lower price just to drive the volumes up.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's one other point to be made.
And so, and maybe you mentioned this, and I apologize if I missed this, but how difficult would it be? So let's say Starship is like 95% to 99% of launch capacity for the next 5 years, whatever the number is.
Yes.
How much benefit would there be to customize your process to be able to hop on Starship? Is that how difficult is that?
I mean, I think that's what everybody's going to have to do, not just us. So we certainly are heading in that direction.
Got it. Okay, that's crazy. I mean, it's like one of the things. It's like them figuring out how to bring the rocket back is a very big deal.
it's a huge deal. Yeah. I mean, there's still a bit of work to be done on the heat shield, but it looks like it looks like they're making amazing progress.
Yeah, they're definitely close. Space debris. How difficult is that to fight through? Is it like one of the things I sometimes read through, a lot of skeptic people in space, let's put aside we never went to the moon folks, but let's go to the guys that are like, hey, like space debris is going to make it impossible to put a lot of stuff up there because it basically means that over time, all your satellites are going to break because you're taking up so much of the space up there. And then that means that a significant percentage of the stuff you put up there is going to fail. So how do you guys think about that problem?
Yeah, it can look like it's a very severe problem when you see a map of, for example, if you see an image of all of the spacecraft moving around the Earth, it looks like it's very congested. It's much less congested than it looks like on those maps. And the reason is you have, we've got some like testing.
They're building satellites over there, bro. They're doing it.
Hello. So that's we're testing the deployment of these solar panels. So I'm not sure if you can hear that in the background. So it's much less than it looks. And the reason is every dot that represents a satellite on that image, they're about the width of California if you actually look underneath. So, the spacecraft, space is actually incredibly empty for the most part. Even if you were to have, you need to be very careful not to have a collision. But if you were to have a collision relatively low, around 500 kilometers, It would only take a few years for most of that debris field to be re-entered. So, yeah, for example, like the Russians did a kinetic test. They basically blew up one of their satellites in relatively low Earth orbit. And, you know, all of those fragments have now deorbited. Here's another fun fact. In the 1970s, the US government deployed 400 million needles about this big into a 3,000 kilometer orbit. And now you might think that's an absolute disaster. And the reason they did it, they were trying to reflect RF off it. And I mean, it is a complete disaster, and you can't ever imagine anybody doing anything like that now. But yeah. I think basically all of those needles have now deorbited. So it's not, yeah, people think that this, if you have one Kessler effect, that you could have this irreversible catastrophe that means space is inaccessible forever. That is extremely, that's just basically impossible because you have really low levels of drag.
Got it. So there's enough, even at 500 kilometers, there's enough atmosphere where over time it will slow down the object enough to where it literally just enters the zone where it's just going to deorbit, and then it will just literally burn up and goodbye. And it'll return to the Earth in its original form, I guess we'll call it. Okay, cool. Man, this interview has been so information packed so far. It's like a lot of the questions that I had, you've been able to answer so succinctly. Initially, I had it scheduled for an hour and a half, and as we're going through, I'm like, holy shit, this is amazing. You're so efficient with your answers, you know?
I love it.
What is a problem that you guys are working through that you wouldn't have thought you have to work through that is like at top of mind right now, if you're able to disclose that? Like, what is a surprising thing you guys are facing right now as you're developing this technology?
It's probably not the answer you were thinking of, but the government being shut for like a few months was very annoying, and still lots of stuff has not been approved for budget. Because, I mean, a lot of what we're doing now is funded by government R&D dollars. I mean, we're funded by VCs, obviously, but it's helpful to also have some validations from DOW. So that's been pretty annoying, to be honest. It looks like things are improving on that front. What else is weird? On the engineering side, I think I mainly covered it. Some of the more surprising things I probably don't want to
reveal. Sure, of course.
Particularly the nuance of the compute module. There's certainly lots of learnings there. All right, I'll give you one. Because it's not going to be useful again, but it was useful for the first one. So we filled our compute module with this phase change material. It's like a paraffin wax. It solidifies and melts when it gets hot or not. As it melts, it expands, right? And so you need to add a valve or something that allows it to expand. And so you can either add a membrane that flexes, or you can add what they call bellows, which contract and expand. All sounds great. The problem is when you put that on a vibration table, now you get these crazy resonance patterns because it's this fiber is vibrating or the bellows are vibrating. And what you don't want is what they call a mode, which is where you have a sort of resonance at a certain frequency. And so we had to come up with a pretty innovative solution that allows expansion but doesn't allow resonance at at a certain frequency.
Wow. And so that resonance would have just created a situation where you have this part that will eventually come loose and create havoc. Like what was the failure mode of that thing?
It's not even necessarily a failure mode. It's that SpaceX has guidelines on what they'll allow for launch. So I think it's something like 35 hertz or 50 hertz. You can't have a mode below, I think let's call it 50 hertz. So if the thing resonates at like 30 times a second, the lower the mode, the more violent the impact of the resonance. So if something's resonating at like twice per second, it's going like this. If it's doing 1,000 times a second, it's going.
Yeah,
that doesn't really matter. So they specify a limit by which they will not allow there to be a mode below. So like, and I think the limit might be something like 50 hertz. And so in order to be approved by SpaceX to fly on launch, they will make you do all of these vibration tests. And if you don't hit their criteria, then you can't launch. And the reason is, like, you've got this whole stack and then our spacecraft is hanging off the side. If this thing starts wobbling at 30 hertz, it can throw off all the parts in the stack, you know?
So that's the kind of stuff, like, when the layman like myself, like, the when we're thinking about rockets, it's like it's that this type of small detail things that's so fascinating to me, because it really gives you an insight into the sort of difficult challenges that companies have to work through in these, like, sort of like nascent difficult industries that will become dominant industries in the next 20 to 50 years. But it's like this little thing that you have to solve for so that the launch provider can allow you to go on, you know? And then you've got the radiator, you have to solve for that, for the chip to, you know, to actually not melt in space. And, you know, what's the right orbit to be? Like, these are like the tiny things that enable the technology to work. And it's just so fascinating to think through. It's so, so cool. The 10 years ago, would you have thought you'd be working on this?
Never in a million years.
Okay. How did that path? Yeah.
I was doing venture capital in South Africa. And I'd spent the last 5 years writing software for high frequency algo trading for an investment bank in London, New York, and Singapore.
Wow.
10 years ago, me, never in a million years would I have thought I was working on this.
Oh my God. And so what attracted you to, I mean, obviously there was a problem that needed to be solved, but was there like some sort of like some sort of inception or something that happened in your life that was like, holy shit, I want to take this on. Like, I want to found a company and lead it.
Yeah. I mean, I founded another company before this. And then after that one, I thought I wanted to get back into the entrepreneurship game, but I didn't want to do something that the last one was, not as impactful as this one. Let's say it was a digital brands aggregation. I thought if I'm going to do entrepreneurship again, then I want it to be something I'm really passionate about and is meaningful. To be honest, I wanted to get into the space industry as well. But there was no way I could get a job at any space company in the US because I didn't have a green card. If SpaceX had given me a job, I would have swept the floors. If I could have worked in Starbase, Texas, honestly, if I could have worked in Starbase, Texas, I would have flown down there and swept the floors for 2 years. I would have done any job. Because I think what they're doing is just like the most phenomenal, awesome stuff ever. But they wouldn't take me without a green card and also space experience. So they probably wouldn't even let me sweep the floors.
That's so crazy.
And then I went down to Starbase, Texas just to look around basically in about 3 years ago and was just super inspired by what they're doing and thought, okay, fuck, the launch cost is going to come down massively in the next 5 to 10 years. That's going to enable an enormous number of new businesses. And one of them that I knew about space-based solar for a long time. I mean, I've been a space nerd forever, but space-based solar was written about by Isaac Asimov in the 40s. And I read the Foundation series when I was a kid. So that's initially what we were looking at was space-based solar. It's like huge solar panels in space and beaming the power down. But then we pretty quickly realized you lose almost all of the energy transmitting it from space to Earth. So you'd much rather consume the energy close to where it's generated. And with low cost launch, you can do things like moving data centers to space. And so that's where this came about basically.
This is so wild, huh? But what percentage of total inference compute do you think will be in space versus Earth in the next by 2035? Like, is it going to be majority in space or you think it's going to be majority on Earth?
No, okay. It'll be close to zero still by 2035. I mean, maybe it'll be 1%. The reason is, it's a bit like, so my expectation is that in 10 years, most new data centers will be being built in space. That's very different from saying in 10 years, most data centers will be in space. And the reason is there's just an enormous stock that's being built out now that is not going to be replaced anytime soon. So it's not like you're going to turn off data centers on Earth. It's a bit like the Tesla build out. Like, we've been mass manufacturing electric cars now for a decade. If you ask what is the total percentage of cars that are electric right now, it's 3 or 4%.
Yeah.
Even though most new cars now being produced in certain places at least are electric.
Yeah.
But the stock just takes a long time to replace.
Got it.
It will be the same for data centers. if you ask me 2050, now you might have a meaningful percentage. Yeah, 2040, 2050, you'll have a meaningful percentage of data centers being run in space.
Which, again, I think speaks to just how much, like the one thing that I'm trying to conceptualize here, you know, is like, what is AI's, because this is all part of the AI infrastructure. This is a super brain infrastructure that we're talking about, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's like, if that is true, doesn't that imply that we're just literally at the first inning of the first inning of the first inning of the first inning of where we're going?
Very, in a very literal sense, yes.
Holy shit. Okay, so AI is not a bubble. Yeah, that's the conclusion.
AI is definitely not a bubble. I mean, the last and largest business ever will be building the Dyson Sphere / Matryoshka brain, which is like a Dyson Sphere hooked up to as much compute as you can physically support. And this is like day zero of building a Dyson Sphere.
Damn, man. That's unbelievable. That's so exciting. Does it feel like you're literally living out a sci-fi like dream, fantasy? Like how's it feel? You know,
it's just come way faster than I was expecting. I mean, I gave a podcast in even before ChatGPT came out, like 2020, I think. I was on a podcast and I've got a clip of it, and I'm basically saying, okay, we're probably living in a simulation, and probably the real world, what it looks like is data centers out as far into the atmosphere as you can support on a planet. And then at the end of it, I said, I mean, I'm pretty sure they'll be on a planet, but maybe they won't be on a planet. And like now it's funny that we're like actually building these things.
That's so crazy, man. That's so crazy. Yeah. Listen, I'm super excited for companies like yours, because it I feel like a company like yours really is a signal that humanity is starting to build things in the real world again. But they're not just building things in the real world, they're building really cool shit in the real world. Like this is the kind of stuff that, you know, like if I'm excited by it today at 38 years old, I can only imagine, like, you know,
I'm
10 year
too,
olds. Oh, nice. Perfect. Yeah. Birthday brothers. When were you born? What month? I'm January 19th.
December 18th.
Okay, cool. All right. Yeah. So I guess I'm a little older than you, technically. So I think, well, so you just, you're, what, you're turning 39?
No. I'll be in 9 days, I'll be 39. So
you're a month.
Yeah. Older.
Got it. Okay. I was going off the year, not the age. Okay, perfect. All right. Well, happy birthday here in a little bit. Are you doing anything fun or no?
I'll be hanging out in the office.
Okay. That's fun.
Building spacecraft.
Yeah. But like the thing I was going to say is like, I can only imagine like what companies like yours do to the younger generation, like your, you know, teenage dudes or girls or whatever that are like looking for things that are happening that are really cool around the world. I feel like them being like, holy shit, like we're putting like going to space used to be a thing. Like obviously satellites are extremely helpful and there's like a economic forcing functions to do that. But like having a launch system across however many companies that would literally give us as much launch capacity as possible to put up a ton of things that are super helpful for humanity, that feels very sci-fi, but it's like real. Because there's actual economic, like there's a forcing function for that thing to happen. And I feel like a lot of like people and a lot of kids are probably looking around like, holy shit, I'm hoping it's like, wow, look at how cool, so, yeah. You know?
Yeah. I really hope, yeah. If we've inspired some, you know, next generation, I really hope so. We had this launch party down in Florida when we launched the first spacecraft. We had maybe 100, at least 100 people came, and people brought their kids and families and stuff. And we printed out these, or actually one of our investors printed out these t-shirts for the kids that said, like, I was at the first StarCloud launch, and it was like very
sick.
Yeah, it was so sick.
That's awesome, dude. That's awesome. Well, congratulations on all your success thus far, man. I think it does feel like you guys are probably just getting started, like literally just getting started. And I'm super excited to track your company and what you guys are doing. I just feel like, again, like I'm not kidding when I say companies like yours make me feel like I'm living in the future. And that's a very exciting thing. You know, like, as somebody who's been following Elon Musk's sort of like his story arc for the last decade plus, and like companies like Tesla, SpaceX and everything like that. Uh-huh. And I'm like starting to look around at other places and I'm starting to see this flourishing of like super interesting, cool companies starting to appear again in the real world, not just like apps and software and stuff, which is awesome. But now there's like physical things that are happening, you know? So, yeah, dude, congratulations on all your success. Is there anything you wanted to mention or talk about before we wrap the sucker up?
Thanks so much. No, I mean, yeah, we're also a huge fan of your work as well. So,
oh, thanks, man.
Appreciate you having me on.
Of course, man. Yeah, no, I appreciate you coming on. And yeah, it's yeah, I'm just so excited. Come back anytime, please. I have so many questions.
Brother.
Awesome, man.